Well, except for the weather, it's good to be home. And I must say, the weather itself is not so unknown to us. Believe it or not, when we were in Egypt just 3 weeks ago, we had a day in which it sleeted. The weather was cold, and an Egyptian cold is more penetrating because you're less prepared for it than one here. So any preconceptions you have in your mind about sunny Egypt, taken off of the posters of the bright sun playing on the sand of the beside the pyramids, remember that it applies. The picture was probably taken in May or June. It certainly wasn't taken in January. I confess it, as a rabbi, I had mixed feelings about going to Egypt. Not that I had any question as to the richness of Egypt's ancient civilization, nor I confess any political qualms about going and seeing something about modern Egypt. It's good to know all you can about those who you must live with as neighbors or as enemies. But so much of the language, the symbolic language of Jewish life, is based on the whole theme of Yetziat Mitzrayim, the going out of Egypt. It was with the Exodus that our ancestors, up till then, a group of anonymous Bedouin and then anonymous slaves, gain an identity, gain a history. In the First Commandment, God defines himself, defines his redemptive power as, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And somehow to willingly go back in seems at first blush to be contradictory. Yet, of course, Egypt has had the longest history of continuous Jewish settlement of any country in the diaspora. There are today less than 100 families, native families in all of Egypt. But for the last 2,700 years, in good times and in bad, the Egyptian Jewish community in the diaspora has been one of the major factors in Jewish life. There were times when it consisted only of a few hundred folk. There were times, as in the end of the first century before the Common Era, where the city of Alexandria alone had over 1 million Jews. And there were times when the whole country of Egypt had a Jewish population which probably numbered over 20% of the total population of the country. So the history, the relationship of Egypt to Israel is an old one. One that goes back to the very beginning of our respective histories. Egyptian history is, of course, much older than Jewish history. The first known pharaoh, the first dynastic pharaoh, lived early in the third millennium before the Common Era, about 1,000 years before Abraham. His name, according to one source, was Narmer. And interestingly, when archaeologists were digging at Tel Gut, which is a site in Israel not far from Jaffa or Ashkelon, they found their shards with the name of King Narmer, Pharaoh Narmer, on them, suggesting that there was already, in that earliest of historic times, important trade contact between the Egyptians and the Canaanites. Abraham, first Jew, had an Egyptian wife. We think of his wife as Sarah, but he had another wife, Hagar. And Hagar was Egyptian. And of the four patriarchs, two of them, Jacob and Joseph, died in Egypt. And Joseph spent most of his life, all of his adult life, in Egypt, according to the Bible, rising to the important role of vizier or overseer of the granaries of Upper and Lower Egypt. Now, the relationship between Egypt and Canaan, Israel, Palestine, you know, call that area what you will, has always been involved in conflicting pressures which both make for trade and peaceful relationships and make for enmity and belligerent relationships. Egypt has always wanted a buffer zone between itself and whatever great empire developed in the Tigris and Euphrates Valley. Whether that empire was Assyria or Babylonia or Persia, Egypt always wanted to have the little area, which is Lebanon, Syria, Canaan, Lebanon, Syria, and Israel, as a buffer zone controlled by its troops, so that if attack came from the other great imperial power of the day, and it had to come through this narrow land corridor, because the rest of that area is wilderness, parched, and desert, there would be a fallback position, and battles could take place outside of Egypt proper. And so throughout the second millennium, the first millennium, there were constant efforts made by whoever was the pharaoh in Egypt to gain suzerainty, gain suasive power, develop defensive alliances with whatever groups were in power in the region which is today Israel. And Israel, or those who lived in Israel, whether it be Judeans or Israelites, always needed Egypt as a place for trade and a place for agricultural purchase. The ancient Egyptian name for their country is Kemi, which means the black earth. Egypt is, as you know, the gift of the Nile. Each year in the subtropical regions of near Lake Victoria and Kenya and Tanganyika, there are the great tropical rains which fill the rivers, and the rivers come rushing down, bringing with them millions of gallons of water and millions of tons of rich earth sediment. And there was, in ancient times, the annual overflow of the Nile. It was predictable. And that overflow brought not only water for irrigation, but topsoil for cultivation. And Egypt could be guaranteed year in and year out, two crops or three crops a year, maize, corn, wheat, cotton, a variety of vegetables. On the other hand, the lands which we call Lebanon, Syria, and Israel depend upon rainfall. And the rainfall in that part of the world is notoriously erratic. And often there can be years on end where there is no substantial rainfall, where regions like our Dust Bowl begin to exist. And at times like this, those who live in that part of the world had to go down to Egypt or send their sons to Egypt, their traders, in order to bring back food supplies to tide the city, to tide the kingdom over. And so there was constant trade and constant military movement between these two countries. And the history of Egypt and Israel from ancient times to our times has been this strange, complex relationship between trade and military necessity, which has led to a very wary, very uncertain neighborliness. At times, Israel and Egypt were allies, particularly when Egypt needed Israel against some mighty power to the east. And many times when Egypt was simply attacking, pillaging, and robbing the Israelite city-states and countryside in order to get the booty, pillage, and to build up lines far away from her own territory. Now, the relationship between Israelites and Egyptians is not only a political one, but a social and cultural one. As you know, according to the Bible, sometime during the age of the patriarchs, The patriarchal clans went down to Egypt and sojourned there. And at first they were very successful, and some of their young men, Joseph notably, rose up to high position in the land. And then at some later time, they were deposed by the natives from their authority, and they were enslaved. And that 200 or 300 or 400 year period is one which we know nothing about. The Bible doesn't contain a single reference about those 400 years. But we do know that even if there was no Jacob and there was no Joseph, the events that are described in these stories are real to the time in which they are placed. There was in Egypt an ancient kingdom, and then an intermediate kingdom where there was chaos and confusion. And then around the year 2300, 2200, a new group of powerful pharaohs came to the throne, the so-called Middle Kingdom. And after a period of about four centuries, that kingdom too fell into disarray. And during that period of disarray, a group of people called the Hyksos, around 1750 before the Common Era, invaded Egypt and dominated Egypt. The archaeologists describe the Hyksos as a varied group of West Asians, Hurrians, Amorites, Canaanites, and others, who had a strategic weapon advantage over the Egyptians. The Egyptians had not yet discovered how to use the wheel in a war chariot, how to have a tank. And Hyksos had these tanks, and they were able to run roughshod over the Egyptian forces. and to dominate the country in a matter of a few decades. But the Hyksos leadership was sparse, and they were really just a feudal military dynasty. And they needed bright young people to man their bureaucracies, and so they looked for scribes among their own back home in Canaan and Anatolia. And they brought down people like Joseph to Egypt and gave them positions of authority. And Joseph, these people brought down their tribes with them, because in those days, one needed one's family for protection and one took care of one's extended clan or tribe. And they prospered as long as the Hyksos prospered, till about the middle of the 16th century, when a nativist pharaoh from Thebes was able to reestablish an Egyptian dynasty, and the Hyksos were thrown out. So the biblical story of power and then enslavement fits into the systole and the diastole of what we know about the general history of the time. And although there is no record of the Exodus itself, no ancient people kept a record of slaves who dashed for freedom and who made it, the idea that at some time in the 13th pre-Christian century, during the reign of one of the Ramses, one of the great Napoleonic builders of Egypt, a group of slaves might have broken out is not at all implausible. We have no idea when it took place. Moses himself might very well have been born and raised in Egypt, because we know now that the name Moses is not a Hebrew name, but it's the same verbal unit that is used in names of people where they have a name and the name of a god in the same theophoric cognomen. Moses means Ben, son of. So Tut Moses, the pharaoh, means the son of the god Tut. And apparently Moses is simply the result of some pious one of our historians, some of our historians, taking it, the great leader of the Exodus, whose name was probably originally one dedicated to some foreign god, cutting out the name of the Egyptian god, the theophoric name that was used, and we're left with Moses, which means simply son of, as the name of the great leader of the Exodus. But these questions of historical detail are less interesting for the development of Jewish life than the question of what Jews learned while they were in Egypt. What did they take away? What do they feel about Egyptian civilization? One of the phrases that fills the Torah is this: Lo tasu kamase inscribe sheyashavta ba. You shall not follow the way of the Egyptians where you once dwelt. And most often this formula is applied to those laws which have to do with sexual relationships, particularly the laws of incest. As you know, the Egyptians believed that their pharaohs were gods. And obviously a god should marry only another god. And so throughout the dynasties of Egypt, brother married sister, first cousin married first cousin, son married mother. There were all forms of incest, all designed to maintain the divinity, the holiness of the royal family, on which so much of the symbolic power of the king, the pharaoh, depended. And all this was anathema, obviously, to the Hebrews. And the laws of the Bible which preclude marriages between relatives who are too closely connected are almost always stated, you shall not do this, you shall not follow the ways of the Egyptians which you saw. And they also speak of not following the ways of the Egyptians in matters which are called snua, matters of dress, of modesty in dress. As you go through ancient Egypt and you look at the tomb paintings, you see that the courtiers were often in diaphanous clothes, very revealing clothes, while the people from West Asia are always dressed in burnouses and tunics, head coverings and coverings which cover their whole body. Their women are veiled. The idea of exposing flesh was anathema to the people of West Asia. And again, whenever the Bible refers to modesty, it uses the Egyptians as the example of immodesty, the model that you are not to follow. We feel also that a great deal of the burial customs of the Jewish tradition are a reaction against the burial customs of ancient Egypt. I'd read, as all of you have read, of the pyramids and the tombs, the caves, the lavishness with which the Egyptians had entombed their pharaohs and their great nobles. They lavishly entombed everyone, if there was any way to do so. And I had not realized until I went to Egypt how far that went. It extended to the fact that as you go down the Nile and you see the great sites, there's not a single palace from ancient Egypt to be seen. The palaces were made of perishable stuff, of mud bricks, which have not weathered over time. Only the temples that are mortuary temples, only the pyramids which are mortuary pyramids, only the caves which are caves where burials took place have survived because they were made of stone. They were solid. That was the expensive material. Wherever they went, whatever they did, the Egyptians made sure that their people were properly buried. And if some of you saw the King Tut exhibit, you saw a fraction, and only a fraction, because we saw the rest of it in the Cairo Museum, of the wealth which was placed in the tomb of this teenage pharaoh who never really effectively ruled in Egypt. Now, having seen this lavish waste, this conspicuous, you can't call it conspicuous consumption because it was never consumed, this conspicuous burial of the wealth of Egypt, our people commanded through the Torah that funerals should be simple, that a body should simply be placed in the earth by the eldest son, allowed to decompose, and then when the body had decomposed at the end of the year, the son would go and pick up the bones and place them in a burial cave or in a little box called an ossuary. There was to be no implements, no wealth, nothing of any kind placed in the ossuary or the burial cave with the bones. They were to be treated with respect. There was no embalming and no wastage of wealth. And to this day, rabbis are constantly telling their congregants that a funeral ought to be simple, done with beauty and with dignity, but done in the way which will be least costly. We are not to lavish the wealth, as we saw the Egyptians lavish the wealth of their country upon the dead. We are to do all that we can for people while they're alive, to spare no expense to keep them healthy and alive. But once they're dead, they're with God, and God will take care of his own. And so Egypt affected Jewish attitudes in many ways, sexually, in terms of attitudes towards death, but not only negatively. Jews were obviously fascinated by the folk legends of ancient Egypt. And many of these appear in the Bible in one form or another. Do you remember the little novella of Joseph? Young Joseph preens himself over his brothers. He has dreams which show that he thinks of himself as far their superior. And they conspire against him, and they sell him ultimately into slavery in Egypt. By a series of events, he is saved from death and from imprisonment. And he's put into the service of a certain Potiphar, a captain of the king's guards in Thebes. And while he's in the service of the king's guards, Potiphar's wife, an aging beauty, takes a fancy to this good-looking young Hebrew, and she makes advances. But being a righteous young man and owing allegiance to his lord and master, Joseph spurns these advances. And hell hath no fury, the woman's scorned, and she turns against Joseph, and she accuses him of having made illicit advances to her, and he ends up right back in the prison from which he had just escaped. Now that little story of the righteous youth who spurns the advances of the wife of his lord and master is a well-known Egyptian tale told about a young prince named Anubis, known as early as the 12th or 13th century before the Common Era, which simply the Hebrew folk tellers took over and added to the story of Joseph. It's a captivating tale, and it shows us a degree of interrelationship between these two cultures. There's more. There was throughout the ancient Middle East a group of people we call scribes. The scribe you can see in many museums depicted by the Egyptians in basalt or stone, squatting with a scroll on his lap, apparently writing on that parchment of papyrus scroll. The scribes were the only literate people in that part of the world at that time. And they held office by virtue of that skill. They could read, they could write, they could keep the king's records, they could keep the record of the collection of the king's taxes. They were terribly important to the management of a complex state. And these scribes moved around from country to country, kingdom to kingdom, because the best of them were sold and bid for like football and baseball stars among competing teams. And over time, they developed a literature which we call the wisdom literature. It's not a religious literature per se, but it's a prudential literature. It's a literature which tells you how to act before the king, how to behave in various kinds of situations, how to be careful with your speech, how to manage your household. And the book of Proverbs, which you know from the Bible, contains about 30 chapters of this wisdom literature, a series of proverbs and maxims and aphorisms from the time. And two chapters in the book of Proverbs, the 21st and 22nd, have now been found to be almost direct translations of instructions of a priest named Amenhotep, who lived about the 8th century before the Common Era, and whose wisdom some Jewish scribe liked, and he added it to his scroll, and so it came down into the Bible. So we not only were repelled by some parts of the Egyptian culture, but we were intrigued by others, particularly the more sophisticated among the Jews being intrigued by the more sophisticated learning among the Egyptians. And if you trace down this relationship, you find that the first translation of the Torah is done in Egypt in around the year 280 before the Common Era, the Septuagint, a translation into Greek done in Alexandria. You find that from about that time down to the first century of the Common Era, the Egyptian diaspora was the American diaspora of our day. It was the center of Jewish power. It was a center of Jewish culture. It developed philosophers and playwrights and poets and historians of note, a great literature, most of which, unfortunately, has been lost to us because when the rabbis of Judea came along and created rabbinic Judaism, they found many of their ideas to be too flexible, too modern, too eclectic for the Judaism which they wished to create. What we have then, what a rabbi finds then as he visits Egypt, is again and again the memory, the shadow of some great event in our own past. We flew down to a place called Elephantine, which is at the first cataract, the first of the cataracts, which is almost at the border between Egypt and the Sudan. And there's an island there called Elephantine. It sits in the middle of the river. The water rushes along both sides of it. And there's a little temple on the island, which has been rebuilt now to a priest, to a god called Num. And if you're a Jew and you know your Jewish history, you see on this island the Jewish mercenary soldiers who encamped there with their families throughout the 5th and 4th centuries before the Common Era, hired by the Persians, Cyrus and Cambyses, to protect the borders of southern Egypt, which they now control. They were the Empire of Persia dominated Egypt in those centuries against the Nubians and the Africans who periodically came up the Nile. And as you move up the Nile, you come to Memphis, and there somehow in the shadows and the ruins, you see what is not to be seen, a building which throughout the Middle Ages stood there as a synagogue. It was a synagogue which was supposedly over the place where the inn had existed, where Moses had taken lodgings when he returned to Egypt as God's ambassadors. It was Israel's first embassy in Egypt. And from about the 4th century to about the 12th century, we know that annually the Egyptian Jews made pilgrimage to this particular synagogue shrine once a year on the 7th of Adar, which was the traditional birthday of Moses, and they offered prayers there. There was a black stone there, very much like the Kaaba stone in Mecca, so they were doing something which was understandable to the Egyptians. And we even have found in the records which have come out of Egypt and somehow survived a poster which was put up near this synagogue, which gave the rules and regulations of behavior and conduct when you came on pilgrimage. You are not to spit in public. You are to keep your voice low. You are to behave with all propriety, all the rules which would be important for any large group of people, any throng, when they came to a particular place. And then when you come to Cairo, you look for the ancient synagogue of Cairo in Fashdat, the Ben Ezra synagogue, and you find yourself led behind the Coptic Museum to an area which is old, which is about 20 or 30 feet below the present street level. And they take the unwary to a building which is said to be the ancient medieval synagogue, but in fact was built sometime probably in the early 19th century. And they show you artifacts which, if you can read the Hebrew, translate Hebrew letters into the appropriate numbers, are not medieval, but were built, show that this altar was built, was dedicated around 1904 or 1905. But the place itself is probably very close to the place where the Jews of Fashdat had a synagogue from about the 6th century AD down, right down through till the late Middle Ages. It was an important synagogue, and next door to it, Maimonides had his home. And how do we know that Maimonides had his home next to the old synagogue? Because in one of his letters, Maimonides complains bitterly of the noise the Jews make at their worship. And you know, this one thing that a rabbi leaves with from any Arab land, and that is the difference in the approach to public worship between Muslims and Jews. Muslim worship is quiet. It's male chauvinist, to be sure, it's only the men. Full of graceful motion. The chant of the cantor can be heard. There's a rhythm to it, a dance rhythm to it, which is absolutely moving. And it's done in reverence and in silence. And if a man cannot, a believer cannot go to the mosque when the muezzin calls out, you can be in his shop. And he will go on his knees and he will offer his prayers, regardless of who's there. A Jew? Can imagine. He would be bashful. Use my children's word, uptight. And Jewish worship has always had a folksiness, a Hamish quality to it, which you don't find in the service of the elsewhere in the Arab world. And it was that noisiness, lack of decorum, which Maimonides complained bitterly about in the 12th century, in which the reformers complained bitterly about in the 19th century, trying to make gentle folk, gentle worshipers out of Jews, has proven to be beyond the capacity of rabbis for 2,000 years. I don't mean that you're not well behaved, but I do mean that services, we're nervous, we're full of nervous energy. We don't sit quietly with attention. It's a totally different feel. Now, for a rabbi to be in Egypt is to see the shadows of the past and for him to sense the shadows of the present. The first thing that you come to understand is that Egypt is really a very small country. My image for Egypt now is a kite. A kite with a very small kite with a very, very long tail and a very small body. The body is the delta land. The tail is the arable land on both sides of the Nile. There are 368,000 square miles in Egypt, not counting the Sinai. In ancient times, less than 8,000 square miles of land was arable. Because of the high dam and other things, they have trebled that number now. But as you take the ship down the Nile, you realize that you're passing through a fertile area which is really no wider than the Galilee. You have that same sense that on the hills on the one side where there is Syria and the hills on the other side where there is Lebanon, you have the end of Egypt. Except in this case, Egypt spreads on, but what you really have is stony wilderness. And sometimes vegetation goes no further than a few yards on either side of the Nile. And clearly, despite the high dam and the very careful use of water, the amount of land which is recoverable in Egypt is now fairly limited. And given that fact, and the population explosion in Egypt, you have the recipe for civil disorder, political disorder, and chaos. In ancient times, Egypt could support a population of between 3 and 6 million people. In 1900, there were something on the order of 10 million people in Egypt. In 1982, there are over 42 million people in Egypt. The Egyptian population is growing by 1 million a year. Every place you look, there are children. And though they are delightful, and most of them look fairly well cared for, they are clearly Egypt's most pressing danger. 2.5 million Egyptians already work outside of Egypt. 1 million in Iraq. 350,000 in Saudi Arabia. Egypt has the highest level of university graduates of any country in the Middle East, including Israel. She is exporting her brains and her brawn and remittances. The remittances of wages for these 2.5 million people are next to the tolls on the canal, the single greatest source of foreign capital income for the Egyptian economy. But there's no sign that the population explosion is diminishing. There's no sign that the Muslim world or the Coptic world in Egypt is willing to accept the idea of contraception and birth control.
Quite the contrary. And so the population continues to multiply. And you recognize, if you have any sense of history, that it will not be long before the Iraqis and the Saudis and the other countries of that part of the world will develop their own native college graduates who can do the oil technology and the electrical technology and the medicine and the law and the architecture. And they'll no longer want these Egyptian expatriates. And then what is Egypt going to do? How's Egypt going to survive? Cairo, they say today, is the second most populated city in the world. It is something over 11 or 12 million people. It is supposed to have the worst housing stock in the world, the most decrepit and dilapidated housing stock in the world. Much of the housing stock outside of the few fine neighborhoods is built out of mud brick. And to provide mud brick for these hovels, they have to take the deposit of topsoil, which is on the fields, and dry them and cart them away. And so for every number of buildings they build in Cairo for this influx of people from the countryside, they take away and destroy the productivity of X numbers of acres of land which Egypt can ill afford. And so whereas in ancient times Egypt was known as the granary of the Eastern Mediterranean, it was the place that Rome got her corn and her grain and her wheat, today Egypt is a net importer of food, and a great deal of her development capital is having to go simply to purchase for abroad the basic necessities of life. The other thing you sense as you visit Egypt, and our visit was simply a tour, it was no sense a search for the full political understanding of the time, but you can't escape the prevailing sense of the military. Every place you go, there are people armed with guns and submachine guns, one kind or another, and almost always you saw live ammunition in their belts or in their hands or in their guns. And as you drive through Cairo particularly, you find government buildings which have before them not simply armed sentries, but dugouts which are sandbagged, both on the up on the walls and down below at the gates, with people with mounted machine guns at the ready. Now, these machine guns in Cairo are not against Israel, obviously. They're concerned for the internal problems which Egypt continues to go through. And you're reminded again that this is the third world, that it is a volatile world, that it is a poverty-stricken world, that it is a world which has not gone through the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation and all of the processes of industrialization and the stresses that just took Europe five centuries to go through. You recognize that there's an unresolved conflict within Islam, whether to modernize or not, and that is being played out. You recognize that there is in Egypt a group of people of great wealth who know English and French, who study and live abroad great periods of time, who have the Western skills, who are very graceful in our eyes. Think of the press in the West that Jihan Sadat received. She seemed to us to be the very, very model of what a president's wife should be like. She was beautifully dressed and beautifully coiffed, and she was doing some social work and was getting her master's degree in art at the university. Everything that a modern Western wife should do. But translate that into pious Orthodox Muslim terms. She is immodest. She appears with bare neck or bare arms, in Western dress, unveiled. She is in business, because politics being what it is in Egypt, Sadat gave her the monopoly on all taxi cabs in Cairo. Families take care of themselves because they know that the wheel of politics rises and falls, and if you're not well prepared in Switzerland when you fall, you may not survive. To Egyptians, Jihan Sadat represents something quite different and far more complex than she represented to us who saw her only from the West. And what is true of Mrs. Sadat is true of the Prime Minister himself. To the West, he was largely the hero of Camp David, the man who had the courage to go to Jerusalem. To the Egyptian, he was the man who promised domestic reform, but largely saw to it that the upper classes of Egypt were able to gain great profits from the first steps in the industrialization of Egypt. The wealthiest contractor in Egypt was his brother, and he became wealthy in very quick order. What you recognize, too, as you walk through Egypt, is that it's a controlled society. There's no free press. There are elections, but there's only one candidate. We met a man who was teaching journalism at the American University, and we asked him, how do you teach some people to be journalists when the government puts out what they may say and what they may not say? And his answer was, well, we're largely women come to us who wouldn't be employed anyway. Essentially, it's a form of education. Some of them may go to London or to Paris or to America to earn a living. Others may simply fade back into their families. Egypt is a country full of contradictions. And it's a country where the future is very uncertain. It has not come to grips with its major problems. And its major problems are technology, industrialization, and all the financing that this requires on the one hand, whether or not the society, the Muslim orthodoxy, will allow the society to develop Western attitudes towards these issues, and on the other hand, the question of the role of the military, the role of autocracy, and most of all, the population explosion. One of the things all of us are going to have to develop new attitudes about are the people on the move, the sea people, the Haitians, the people from Dominica, the Vietnamese, the people who can no longer find employment wherever they live. At some point or other, given the population explosion, every country is going ultimately to raise barriers against cheap labor coming in. Particularly as Europe has reached 9-10% unemployment, America comes close to that. As the jobs which Americans and Europeans will no longer fill become filled, and since there are no other jobs, some natives are willing to take them, low-order jobs, the demand will be to close the doors. And then the countries of the third world, which are overpopulated and their number is increasing year by year, will no longer be able to export people. And then what? Then how do they survive? What kind of instability do they bring to their own domestic scene and ultimately to the international scene? I would guess that the relationships, and I close with this, between Israel and Egypt depend less on who is in control in Egypt now or 5 years from now than they do on whether or not that person will need to divert his population by foreign conquest, by war, as Hitler diverted the Germans from the failure from the Depression, or whether he will be willing to go after the tough, difficult development decisions and population decisions and not feel the need for these kinds of military diversions which take people's minds off of their stomachs and onto the ephemeral value of a military victory. If the conditions get as difficult as I'm afraid they're going to, whatever the arrangements which ultimately come out of Camp David or its successor, they will not hold unless Egypt comes to grips with the real immediate problems, economic and population problems, demographic problems which it faces. And frankly, we saw, in a very superficial way, but we saw very little evidence that that kind of concerted effort was now being undertaken. Amen.